Anunnaki was a serious sexual transgression. In the earliest times, when the first teams of astronauts had landed on Earth, a court-martial sentenced their supreme commander Enlil to exile for having raped a young nurse, whom he later married. Dumuzi had surely known all this, so he either expected his sister to engage in the intercourse willingly, or else had compelling reasons for his deed which overrode the prohibition. Inanna's prior consent brings to mind the biblical tale of Abraham and his sonless wife Sarah, who offered him her maidservant so that he might have a male heir. Aware that he had done a horrible deed, Dumuzi was soon thereafter seized with a premonition that he was to pay for his deed with his life, as told in the Sumerian text, Shaga-ni-er-im-shi. His heart was filled with tears. Composed in the form of a self-fulfilling dream, the text relates how Dumuzi fell asleep and dreamed that all his attributes of status and property were being taken away from him one by one by the princely bird and a falcon. The nightmare ended with Dumuzi seeing himself lying dead in the midst of his sheepfolds. Waking up, he asked his sister, Geshtinanna, to tell him the meaning of the dream. "My brother," she said, "your dream is not favorable. It is very clear to me. It foretold bandits rising against you from ambush. Your hands will be bound in handcuffs. Your arms will be bound in fetters." No sooner had Geshtinanna finished talking than the evil ones appeared beyond the hill and caught Dumuzi. Bound in handcuffs and fetters, Dumuzi cried out an appeal to Utu Shamash. "O Utu, you are my brother-in-law. I am your sister's husband. Change my hands into a gazelle's hands. Change my feet into a gazelle's feet. Let me escape the evil ones." Hearing his appeal, Utu enabled Dumuzi to escape. After some adventures, Dumuzi sought a hiding place in the house of old Balili, a questionable character playing a double role. Dumuzi was captured again, and again escaped. In the end, he found himself hiding once again in the sheepfolds. A strong wind was blowing, the drinking cups were overturned, the evil ones closed in on him, all as he had seen in his dream. And in the end, the drinking cups lay on their side, Dumuzi was dead, the sheepfold was thrown into the wind. The arena of these events, in this text, is a desert-like plain near a river. The geography is enlarged upon in another version of the events, a text titled The Most Bitter Cry. Composed as a lament by Inanna, it tells how 7 deputies of Kerr enter the sheepfold and arouse Dumuzi from his sleep. Unlike the previous version, which simply referred to the seizure of Dumuzi by evil ones, this text makes it clear that they had come on higher authority. "My master has sent for you," the chief deputy announced to the awakened god. They proceed to strip Dumuzi of his divine attributes. "Take the divine headdress off your head. Get up bareheaded. Take the royal robe off your body. Get up naked. Lay aside the divine staff which is in your hand. Get up empty-handed. Take the holy sandals off your feet. Get up barefooted." The seized Dumuzi manages to escape and reaches the river at the great dike in the desert of Emush, home of the snakes. There was only one such place in Egypt where desert and river met at a great dike, at the first Nile cataract, the place where nowadays the great dam of Aswan is located. But the swirling waters did not let Dumuzi reach the other riverbank, where his mother and Inanna were standing by to offer him protection. Instead, there did the boat-wrecking waters carry the lad towards Kerr. To Kerr did the boat-wrecking waters carry the espoused of Inanna. This and other parallel texts reveal that those who had come to seize Dumuzi were in fact arresting him in accordance with the orders given by a higher god, the master of Kerr, who a sentence did pass upon him. But it could not have been a sentence passed by the full assembly of the gods. In Lilite gods, such as Utu Shamash and Inanna, were helping Dumuzi escape. The sentence then was one-sided, passed only by the authority of the master of the arresting deputies. He was none other than Marduk, the elder brother of both Dumuzi and Geshtinana. His identity comes through in the text, named by scholars The Myths of Inanna and Belulu. In it, the shady old Balili turns out to have been a male, the Lord Belulu, En Belulu, in disguise, and the very deity who directed the punitive action against Dumuzi. Akkadian texts dealing with divine epithets explained that Enbilulu was Il-Marduk Shah-Hatati, the god Marduk who had sinned, and the sorrower of Inanna. Having disapproved of the Dumuzi-Inanna love match from the beginning, Marduk, no doubt, was even more opposed to the union after the Pyramid Wars. The rape of Geshtinana by Dumuzi, politically motivated, was thus an opportunity for Marduk to block the designs Inanna had on Egypt, by seizing and punishing Dumuzi. Did Marduk intend to put Dumuzi to death? Probably not. Solitary exile was the customary punishment. The death of Dumuzi, in a manner that has remained unclear, was probably accidental. But whether accidental or not was irrelevant to Inanna. As far as she was concerned, Marduk had caused her beloved's death, and as the texts make clear, she sought revenge. What is in holy Inanna's heart? To kill the Lord Belulu. Working with fragments found in the collections of Mesopotamian tablets, dispersed in several museums, scholars have pieced together parts of a text that Samuel N. Kramer named Inanna and Ebi. He considered it as belonging to the cycle of slaying of the dragon myths, for it deals with Inanna's struggle against an evil god hiding inside the mountain. The available fragments relate how Inanna armed herself with an array of weapons to attack the god in his hiding place. Though the other gods tried to dissuade her, she confidently approached the mountain, which she called Ebi, abode of sorrowful calling. Haughtily she proclaimed, "Mountain, thou art so high, thou art elevated above all others, thou touchest the sky with thy tip, yet I shall destroy thee, to the ground I shall fell thee, inside thine heart pain I will cause." That the mountain was the Great Pyramid, that the confrontation was at Giza in Egypt, is evident not only from the texts, but also from a depiction on a Sumerian cylinder seal, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 73. Inanna, shown in her familiar enticing half-naked pose, is seen confronting a god based upon three pyramids. The pyramids are depicted exactly as they appear to view in Giza. The Egyptian Ankh sign, the priest in an Egyptian headdress, and the entwined serpents add up to one locale, Egypt. As Inanna continued to challenge Marduk, now hiding inside the mighty structure, her fury rose as he ignored her threats. For the second time, infuriated by his pride, Inanna approached the pyramid again and proclaimed, "My grandfather Enlil has permitted me to enter inside the mountain." Flaunting her weapons, she haughtily announced, "Into the heart of the mountain I shall penetrate. Inside the mountain, my victory I shall establish." Getting no response, she began her attack. She ceased not striking the sides of Ebi, and all its corners, even its multitude of raised stones. But inside, the great serpent who had gone in his poison ceased not to spit. Anu himself then intervened. The god hiding inside, he warned her, possessed awesome weapons. Their outburst is terrible. They will prevent you from entering. Instead, Anu advised her to seek justice by putting the hiding god on trial. The texts amply identify this god, as in the Ninurta texts, he is called Azag, and nicknamed the Great Serpent, a name and a derogatory Enlilite epithet for Marduk. His hiding place is also clearly identified as the Eker, whose walls awesomely reach the skies, the Great Pyramid. The record of the trial and the sentencing of Marduk is available from a fragmentary text published by the Babylonian section of the Museum of the University of Pennsylvania. The extant lines begin where the gods had surrounded the pyramid, and a god chosen to be a spokesman addressed Marduk in his enclosure. The one who was evil, he implored. Marduk was moved by the message. Despite the anger of his heart, clear tears came into his eyes, and he agreed to come out and stand trial. The trial was held within sight of the pyramids, in a temple by the riverbank. To the place of reverence by the river, with him who was accused, they stepped. In truth, they made the enemies stand aside. Justice was performed. In sentencing Marduk, the mystery of Dumuzi's death posed a problem. That Marduk was responsible for his death, there was no doubt. But was it premeditated or accidental? Marduk deserved a death sentence, but what if his crime was not deliberate? Standing there in sight of the pyramids, with Marduk fresh out of his hiding place, the solution dawned on Inanna, and she proceeded to address the gods. On this day, the lady herself, she who speaks truth, the accuser of Azag, the great princess, an awesome judgment uttered. There was a way to sentence Marduk to death without actually executing him, she said. Let him be buried alive within the Great Pyramid. Let him be sealed there as in a gigantic envelope, in a great envelope that is sealed, with no one to offer him nourishment, alone to suffer, the potable water source to be cut off. The judging gods accepted her suggestions. The mistress art thou, the fate thou decreest. Let it be so. Assuming that Anyu would go along with the verdict, the gods then placed the command to heaven and earth. The Eker, the Great Pyramid, had become a prison, and one of the epithets of its mistress was, thereafter, Mistress of the Prison. It was then, we believe, that the sealing of the Great Pyramid was completed. Leaving Marduk alone in the king's chamber, the arresting gods released behind them the granite plugs of the ascending passage, irrevocably blocking tight all access to the upper chambers and passages. Through the channels leading from the king's chamber to the north and south faces of the pyramid, Marduk had air to breathe, but he had neither food nor water. He was buried alive, doomed to die in agony. The record of Marduk's entombment, alive, within the Great Pyramid, has been preserved on clay tablets found in the ruins of Asher and Nineveh, the ancient Assyrian capitals. The Asher text suggests that it had served as a script for a New Year's mystery play in Babylon that reenacted the gods' suffering and reprieve. But neither the original Babylonian version nor the Sumerian historical text on which the script was based have so far been found. Heinrich Zimmern, who transcribed and translated the Asher text from clay tablets in the Berlin Museum, created quite a stir in theological circles when he announced its interpretation at a lecture in September 1921. The reason was that he interpreted it as a pre-Christian mysterium dealing with the death and resurrection of a god, and thus an earlier Christ tale. When Stephen Langdon included an English translation in his 1923 volume on the Mesopotamian New Year mystery texts, he titled the text The Death and Resurrection of Bel Marduk and highlighted its parallels to the New Testament tale of the death and resurrection of Jesus. But as the text relates, Marduk, or Bel, the Lord, did not die. He was indeed incarcerated inside the mountain as in a tomb, but he was entombed alive. The ancient script begins with an introduction of the actors. The first one is Bel, who was confined in the mountain. Then there is a messenger who brings the news of the imprisonment to Marduk's son, Nabu. Shocked by the news, Nabu hastens to the mountain in his chariot. He arrives at a structure, and the script explains, "That is the house at the edge of the mountain, wherein they question him." In reply to the guards' questions, they are told that the agitated god is Nabu, who from Borsippa comes. It is he who comes to seek after the welfare of his father who is imprisoned. Actors then come out and rush about on the stage. They are the people who in the streets hasten. They seek Bel, saying, "Where is he held captive?" We learn from the text that after Bel had gone into the mountain, the city fell into tumult, and because of him, fighting within it broke out. A goddess appears. She is Sharpanit, a sister wife of Marduk. She is confronted by a messenger, who weeps before her, saying, "Unto the mountain they have taken him." He shows her the garments of Marduk, possibly blood-stained. "These are his raiment, which they took off him," he says. "Instead of these," he reports, "Marduk with a garment of sentence was clothed." What the audience is shown are shrouds. That means, in a coffin he is. Marduk has been buried. Sarpanit goes to a structure that symbolizes Marduk's tomb. She sees a group of mourners. The script explains, "These are those who make lament after the gods had locked him up, separating him from among the living. Into the house of captivity, away from the sun and light, they put him in prison." The drama has reached its ominous peak. Marduk is dead. But wait, all hope is not lost. Sarpanit recites an appeal to the two gods who can approach Inanna regarding Marduk's incarceration, her father Sin, and her brother Utu Shamash. She prays to Sin and Shamash, saying, "Give life to Bel." Priests, a stargazer, and messengers now appear in procession, reciting prayers and incantations. Offerings are made to Ishtar, that she may show her mercy. The high priest appeals to the supreme god, to Sin and to Shamash. "Restore Bel to life." Now the drama takes a new turn. Suddenly the actor who represents Marduk, clothed with shrouds which with blood are dyed, speaks out, "I am not a sinner. I shall not be smitten." He announces that the supreme god has reviewed his case and found him not guilty. Who, then, was the murderer? The attention of the audience is diverted to a doorpost. It is the doorpost of Sarpanit in Babylon. The audience learns that the real guilty god has been captured. They see his head through the doorway. That is the head of the evildoer, whom they shall smite and slay. Nabu, who had returned to Borsippa, comes back from Borsippa. He comes and stands over the evildoer and regards him. We do not learn the identity of the evildoer, except to be told that Nabu had seen him before in Marduk's company. "This is the sinner," he says, and thereby seals the captive's fate. The priests grab the evildoer. He is slain. The one whose sin it was is carried away in a coffin. The murderer of Dumuzi has paid with his life. But is the sin of Marduk, as the indirect cause of Dumuzi's death, atoned? Sarpanit reappears, wearing the garments of atonement. Symbolically, she wipes away the blood that has been spilled. With pure water, she washes her hands. It is water for hand washing which they bring after the evildoer has been carried away. In all the sacred places of Bel, torches are lit. Again, appeals are directed to the supreme god, the supremacy of Ninurta, which had once been proclaimed when Ninurta vanquished Zu, is reasserted, apparently to allay any fear that a released Marduk might become a challenger for supremacy among the gods. The appeals succeed, and the supreme god sends the divine messenger, Nusku, to announce the good tidings to all the gods. As a gesture of goodwill, Gula, the spouse of Ninurta, sends to Sarpanit new clothing and sandals for Marduk. Marduk's driverless chariot also appears, but Sarpanit is dumbfounded. She cannot understand how Marduk can be free again if he had been imprisoned in a tomb that cannot be unsealed. How can they let him free? the one who cannot come out. Nusku, the divine messenger, tells her that Marduk shall pass through the Sabad, the chiseled upper opening. He explains that it is Dalat Biri Sha Ikabuni Ilani, a doorway shaft which the gods will bore. Shunu, Itashrushu, Inabiti, Itarba, its vortex they will lift off, his abode they shall enter. Dalta, Ina, Panishu, Etadili, the door which was barred before him. Shunu, Horate, Inalibi, Dalti, Uptalishu, at the vortex of the hollowing, into the insides, a doorway they shall twistingly bore. Karabu, Inalibi, Upushu, getting near into its midst, they will break through. This description of how Marduk shall be released has remained meaningless to scholars, but the verses are explosively meaningful to us. As we have explained, the irregular and twisting segment C of the well shaft had not existed when the pyramid was completed, and when Marduk was imprisoned within it. It was instead the very doorway shaft which the gods will bore to rescue Marduk. Still familiar with the pyramid's inner layout, the Anunnaki realized that the shortest and quickest way to reach the starved Marduk was to tunnel a connecting shaft between the existing segments B and D, a tunneling of a mere 32 feet through the relatively soft limestone blocks. It was a task that could be achieved not in days, but in hours. Removing the stone that covered the well shaft's entrance from the descending passage to G, the rescuers quickly climbed up inclined segments F and E. Where E connected with vertical segment D, a granite stone covered the entrance in the grotto. It was pushed aside and still lies there in the grotto, as we have shown in Figure 70, which can be found in the bonus PDF. Now the rescuers climbed the short distance up segment D and faced the first course of the pyramid's masonry. 32 feet above, but to the side, lay the bottom of vertical segment B and the way into the grand gallery. But who could have known how to bore a twisting connecting shaft, C, except those who had built the pyramid, knew of its inner sealed-off upper sections, and had the plans to locate them? It was the rescuers of Marduk, we suggest, who used their tools to break through the limestone blocks, the link between D and B. A hollowing into its insides, they shall twistingly bore, in the words of the ancient text. Achieving the link up with B, they clambered to the short horizontal passage A. There, any stranger would have stopped short even if he had gone that far up, for all he would have seen would be a stone wall, solid masonry. Again, we suggest that only the Anunnaki, who had the pyramid's plan, could have known that beyond the stone facing them, there lay the immense cavity of the grand gallery, the queen's chamber, and all the other upper chambers and passages of the pyramid. To gain access to those chambers and passages, it was necessary to remove the wedge-like ramp stone, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 72. But it was wedged too tightly and could not be moved. If the stone would have been moved away, it would have still been lying there, in the grand gallery. Instead, there is a gaping hole, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 68. And those who have examined it have invariably used the words blown up and blown open to describe what it looks like. And it was done not from the gallery, but from inside the shaft. The hollow has the appearance of having been burst open by tremendous force from within the shaft. Again, the Mesopotamian record offers a solution. The stone was indeed removed from within the horizontal passageway, because it was from there that the rescuers had arrived. And it was indeed burst open by a tremendous force. In the words of the ancient text, getting near into its midst, they will break through. The fragments of the limestone block slid down the ascending passage, down all the way to the granite plugs. That is where Al-Mamun's men found them. The explosion also covered the Grand Gallery with the fine white dust the Arabs had found covering the floor of the Grand Gallery, mute evidence of the ancient explosion and the gaping hole it had left. Having broken through into the Grand Gallery, the rescuers led Marduk back the way they came. The entry from the descending passage was sealed up again, to be discovered by Al-Mamun's men. The granite plugs remained in place, with the triangular junction stone hiding the plugs and the ascending passage for millennia. And inside the pyramid, the original upper and lower parts of the well shaft were now, for all future days, connected by a twisting, harshly tunneled segment. And what of the rescued prisoner of the pyramid? Mesopotamian texts relate that he went into exile. In Egypt, Ra acquired the epithet Amun, the Hidden One. Circa 2000 BC, he reappeared to claim again supremacy. For that, mankind ended up paying a most bitter price. Chapter 11. A Queen Am I? The tale of Inanna, Ishtar, is a tale of a self-made goddess. Neither one of the olden gods, the original group of astronauts from the 12th planet, nor even a firstborn daughter of one of them, she nevertheless propelled herself to the highest ranks and ended up a member of the Pantheon of 12. To achieve that, she combined her cunning and her beauty with ruthlessness, a goddess of war and a goddess of love, who counted among her lovers both gods and men. And it was she of whom there had been a true case of death and resurrection. Inasmuch as the death of Dumuzi was brought about by Inanna's desire to become a queen on earth, the imprisonment and exile of Marduk did little to satisfy her ambitions. Now, having challenged and prevailed over a major god, she felt she could no longer be deprived of a domain of her own. But where? The funeral of Dumuzi, one gathers from such texts as Inanna's Descent to the Lower World, was held in the Land of Mines, in southern Africa. It was the domain of Inanna's sister Ereshkigal and her spouse Nergal. Enlil and Nannar, even Enki, advised Inanna not to go there, but she made up her mind. From the great above, she set her mind toward the great below, and when she arrived at the gate of her sister's capital city, she said to the gatekeeper, "Tell my elder sister, Ereshkigal, that she had come to witness the funeral rites." One would expect the meeting between the sisters to have been heartwarming, filled with sympathy for the bereaved Inanna. We learn instead that Inanna, who came uninvited, was received with unrestrained suspicion. As she was let through the seven gates of the city leading to Ereshkigal's palace, she was made to give up her emblems and regalia of divine status. When Inanna finally came into the presence of her sister, she found her sitting on her throne, surrounded by seven Anunnaki, with a judicial capacity. They fastened their eyes upon her, the eyes of death. They said angry things to her, words which torture the spirit. Instead of being welcomed, Inanna was sentenced to be hung as a corpse from a stake. It was only through the intervention of Enki that she was saved and revived. The texts do not explain the reasons for the harsh treatment meted out to Inanna, nor quote the torturing words her accusers cast at her. But we learn from the beginning of the text that at the same time that she went on her trip, Inanna sent her messenger to fill heaven with complaints for me, in the assembly of the gods, cry out for me. Attending a funeral was thus a mere pretext. What she had in mind was to force the gods to satisfy a complaint that she wished to dramatize. From the moment of her arrival at the first gate, Inanna threatened violence if she would not be let in. When the news of her arrival was brought to Ereshkigal, her face turned pale, her lips turned dark, and she wondered out loud what the real purpose of the visit was. When the two came face to face, Ereshkigal saw her and burst out at her presence. Ishtar, unflinching, flew at her. Somehow Inanna's intentions spelled danger for Ereshkigal. We have already found that many of the biblical marital and succession laws were akin to such laws that governed the behavior of the Anunnaki. The rules regarding a half-sister are but one example. The clue to Inanna's intentions, we believe, can be found in the book of Deuteronomy, the fifth book of Moses, in which the Hebrew code of personal behavior was spelled out. Chapter 25 deals with the instance when a married man dies without having a son. If the man had a brother, the widow could not remarry a stranger. It was the duty of the brother, even a married one, to marry his widowed sister-in-law and have children by her. And the firstborn boy was to bear the name of the deceased brother, so that his name shall not be blotted out. This, we believe, is what had also been Inanna's reason for her risky journey. For Ereshkigal was married to Nergal, a brother of Dumuzi. Inanna had come to put the rule into play. The custom, we know, put the onus on the eldest brother, who was, in the case of the sons of Enki, Marduk. But Marduk was found guilty of indirectly causing the death of Dumuzi, and was punished and exiled. Had Inanna then the right to demand that the next in line, Nergal, take her as his second wife, so that she could have a male heir? The personal and succession problems that Inanna's intentions would have caused Ereshkigal can well be imagined. Would Inanna be satisfied to be a second wife? Or would she connive and scheme to usurp the queenship over the African domain? Obviously, Ereshkigal was not willing to take chances. And so it was, we believe, that after harsh words between the sisters, Inanna was hauled before a hastily convened court of seven Anunnaki who judge, was found in violation of the rules, and was summarily hung on a stake to die a slow death. She survived only because her father-in-law Enki, on hearing the terrible news, rushed two emissaries to save her. Upon the corpse they directed that which pulsates and that which radiates. They administered to her the water of life and the food of life, and Inanna arose. Back in Sumer, the revived Inanna, heartbroken and lonely, spent her time on the banks of the Euphrates River, tending a wild-growing tree and voicing her sorrows. When at last shall I have a holy throne, that I may sit on it? When at last shall I have a holy bed, that I may lie on it? Concerning this Inanna spoke, she who let her hair down is ill at heart, the pure Inanna. Oh, how she weeps! One who had taken pity on, and a liking to, Inanna, was her great-grandfather, Anu. It is known from Sumerian texts that Inanna, who was born on earth, went up to heaven at least once. It is also known that Anu had visited earth on several occasions. When and where exactly did Anu embrace Inanna as his Anu Nitum, beloved of Anu, is not clear. But it was more than mere Sumerian gossip when texts hinted that the love between Anu and his great-granddaughter was more than platonic. Assured thus of sympathy at the highest level, Inanna raised the issue of a dominion, a land to rule over. But where? The treatment meted out to Inanna, whatever its reasons, made it clear that she could not expect to attain a dominion in Africa. Her spouse Dumuzi was dead, and with him died her claims to queenship in the lands of Enki's descendants. If her suffering and prevailing over a major god entitled her to a dominion of her own, it had to be elsewhere. But Mesopotamia, too, and the lands bordering on Mesopotamia, were all spoken for. Where could Inanna be given dominion? Casting their eyes about, the gods came up with an answer. The texts dealing with the death of Dumuzi, as well as with the imprisonment of Marduk, mention the names of Sumerian cities and their populace. This suggests that those events had taken place after the Sumerian urban civilization had already begun, circa 3800 BC. On the other hand, the Egyptian background of the tales makes no reference to urban settlements and describes a pastoral environment, suggesting a time prior to 3100 BC, when urban civilization in Egypt began. In the writings of Manetho, a chaotic period of 350 years is said to have preceded the urban kingship of Menes. That period between 3450 and 3100 BC appears to have been the time of the troubles and tribulations triggered by Marduk, the Tower of Babel incident, and the Dumuzi affair, when a god of Egypt was captured and killed, when the great god of Egypt was imprisoned and exiled. It was then, we believe, that the Anunnaki turned their attention to the third region of the Indus Valley, where civilization began soon thereafter. Unlike the Mesopotamian and Egyptian civilizations that lasted for millennia and continued to this very day, through offspring civilizations, the one in the third region lasted only a millennium. Soon thereafter it began to decline, and by 1600 BC it was totally gone, its cities in ruins, its people dispersed. Human plunder and the ravages of nature gradually obliterated the civilization's remains. In time, it was totally forgotten. It was only in the 1920s that archaeologists, led by Sir Mortimer Wheeler, began to unearth two principal centers and several sites in between, stretching over more than 400 miles from the Indian Ocean coast northward, along the Indus River and its tributaries. Both sites, Mohenjo-Daro to the south and Harappa in the north, show that they were cities of substance, some 3 miles in circumference. High walls ran around and within the cities. These walls, as well as the public and private buildings, were all constructed of bricks made of clay or mud. Originally, there were so many of these bricks that in spite of constant ransacking by subsequent home builders, both in ancient times, as well as more recently for such purposes as ballast for the Lahore Multan Railroad, enough still remained standing to reveal the site of the cities and the fact that they were laid out in accordance with preconceived city-building plans. At both sites, the city was dominated by a necropolis, a raised area of citadels and temples. In both instances, these structures were of the same measurements and similarly oriented exactly on a north-south axis, proving that their builders followed strict rules when it came to erecting the temples. In both cities, the second largest feature was immense granaries, grain silos of a vast size and impressive functionality situated near the riverbank. This suggests that grains were not only the chief crop, but also the chief export product of the Indus civilization. The cities and the few artifacts that were still found in their remains, furnaces, urns, pottery, bronze tools, copper beads, some silver vessels and ornaments, all attest to a high civilization that was suddenly transplanted from elsewhere. Thus, the two earliest brick buildings at Mohenjo-Daro, a huge granary and a fort tower, were reinforced with timbers, a construction method totally unsuitable to the Indus climate. This method, however, was soon abandoned, and all subsequent construction avoided timber reinforcing. Scholars have concluded from this that the initial builders were foreigners accustomed to their own climatic needs. Seeking the fountainhead of the Indus civilization, scholars concluded that it could not have arisen independently of the Sumerian civilization, which preceded it by almost 1,000 years. In spite of notable differentiations, such as the yet undeciphered pictographic script, the analogies to Mesopotamia are everywhere. The use of dried mud or clay bricks for construction, the layout of city streets, the drainage system, the chemical methods used for etching, for glazing, and for bead making, the shapes and design of metal daggers and jars, all bear striking similarity to what had been uncovered at Ur or Kish, or other Mesopotamian sites. Even the designs and symbols on pottery, seals, and other clay objects are virtual duplicates of those of Mesopotamia. Significantly, the Mesopotamian sign of the cross, the symbol of Nibiru, the home planet of the Anunnaki, was also prevalent throughout the Indus civilization. Which gods did the people of the Indus Valley worship? The few pictorial depictions that have been found show them wearing the divine Mesopotamian horned headdress. More abundant clay figurines indicate that the dominant deity was a goddess, usually naked and bare-chested, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 74A, or with rows of beads and necklaces as her sole covering, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 74B. These were well-known depictions of Inanna, found in abundance in Mesopotamia and throughout the Near East. It is our suggestion that in their search for a land for Inanna, the Anunnaki decided to make the third region her dominion. Although it is generally held that the evidence for the Mesopotamian origins of the Indus civilization and for ongoing contacts between Sumer and the Indus Valley is limited to the few archaeological remains, we believe that there also exists textual evidence attesting to these links. Of particular interest is a long text named by scholars in Merkar and the Lord of Arata, whose background is the rise to power of Uruk, the biblical Erech, and of Inanna. The text describes Arata as the capital of a land situated beyond mountain ranges and beyond Anshan, i.e., beyond southeastern Iran. This is precisely where the Indus Valley lay, and such scholars as J. Van Dish have surmised that Arata was a city situated on the Iranian plateau or on the Indus River. What is most striking is the fact that the text speaks of the grain silos of Arata. It was a place where wheat was growing of itself, beans also growing of themselves, crops growing and stored in the storehouses of Arata. Then, to be exported, they poured grain into sacks, loaded them on the crate-carrying donkeys, and placed them on the sides of the transporting donkeys. Arata's geographical location, and the fact that it is a place renowned for its grain and bean storehouses, bear forceful similarities to the Indus civilization. Indeed, one must wonder whether Harappa, or Arapa, is not a present-day echo of the ancient Arata. The ancient tale takes us back to the beginning of kingship at Erech, when a demigod, the son of Utu Shamash, by a human female, was both high priest and king at the sacred precinct from which the city was to develop. Circa 2900 BC, he was succeeded by his son, Inmerkar, who built Uruk, according to the Sumerian king lists, transforming it from the nominal abode of an absentee god, Anu, to a major urban center of a reigning deity. He achieved this by persuading Inanna to choose Erech as her principal seat of power, and by aggrandizing for her the Inanna, House of Anu Temple. We read in the ancient text that at first all Inmerkar demanded of Arata was that it contribute precious stones, bronze, lead, slabs of lapis lazuli, to the building of the enlarged temple, as well as artfully fashioned gold and silver, so that the holy mount, being raised for Inanna, would be worthy of the goddess. But no sooner was this done than the heart of Inmerkar grew haughty. A drought had afflicted Arata, and Inmerkar now demanded not only materials, but also obedience. Let Arata submit to Erech, he demanded. To achieve his purpose, Inmerkar sent to Arata a series of emissaries to conduct what S.N. Kramer has characterized as the first war of nerves. Lauding his king and his powers, the emissary quoted verbatim Inmerkar's threats to bring desolation upon Arata and dispersion upon its people. The ruler of Arata, however, countered this war of nerves with a ploy of his own, reminding the emissary of the confusion of languages in the aftermath of the Tower of Babel incident, he claimed he could not understand the message given him in Sumerian. In frustration, Enmerkar sent another message written on clay tablets. This time it appears in the language of Arata, a feat made possible with the help of Nidaba, the goddess of writing. In addition to threats, an offering of the seeds of the olden grain that had been kept in Anyu's temple was made. A seed, it appears, needed badly in Arata because a long drought had destroyed its crops. The drought was deemed to have been a sign that it was Inanna herself who wished Arata to come under the protecting shade of Erech. The Lord of Arata, from the herald, took the baked tablet. The Lord of Arata examined the clay. The writing was in cuneiform script. The dictated word was nail-like in appearance. Was he to yield or resist? Just at that moment, a storm, like a great lion attacking, stepped up. The drought was suddenly broken by a thunderstorm that made the whole land tremble, the mountains quake, and once again, white-walled Arata became a land of abundant grains. There was no need to yield to Erech, and the Lord of Arata said to the herald, Inanna, the queen of the lands, has not abandoned her house in Arata. She has not handed over Arata to Erech. In spite of the rejoicing in Arata, its expectation that Inanna would not abandon her abode there was not entirely fulfilled. Enticed by the prospect of residing in a grand temple at Sumer's city of Anyu, she became a commuting goddess, a working deity, so to speak, in faraway Arata, but a resident in metropolitan Erech. She did her commuting by flying from place to place in her boat of heaven. Her flying about gave rise to many depictions of her as an aeronaut, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 75. And the inference from some texts is that she did her own piloting. On the other hand, like other major deities, she was assigned a pilot navigator for the more demanding flights. As the Vedas, which spoke of pilots of the gods, one Pushan, guided Indra through the speckled clouds and the golden ship that travels in the air's mid-region, so did the earlier Sumerian texts refer to the Abgals, who ferried the gods across the heavens. Inanna's pilot navigator, we are told, was Nungal, and he was specifically named in regard to her transfer to the House of Anyu in Erech. At the time when Enmerkar in Uruk ruled, Nungal, the lion-hearted, was the pilot who from the skies brought Ishtar down to the Inanna. According to the Sumerian king lists, kingship after the deluge began at Kish. Then the kingship to the Inanna was carried. As archaeologists have confirmed, Erech indeed had its beginnings as a temple city, consisting of the sacred precinct where Anu's first modest shrine, White Temple, was built atop a raised platform, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 76. The site remained in the city's heart even as Erech grew, and its temples were aggrandized, as the remains of the city and its walls indicate, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 77. Archaeologists have come upon the remains of a magnificent temple dedicated to Inanna and dating to the early part of the 3rd millennium BC, possibly the very temple constructed by Enmerkar. It was uniquely built with decorated high columns, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 78, and must have been as lavish and impressive as the hymns that sang its praises had described. With lapis lazuli was adorned, decorated with the handiwork of Ninagal, in the bright place, the residence of Inanna, the lyre of Anyu they installed. With all that, Erech was still a provincial town, lacking the stature of other Sumerian cities, which had the distinction of having been rebuilt on the sites of pre-diluvian cities. It lacked the status and benefits that stemmed from the possession of the divine Mies. Though they are constantly referred to, the nature of the Mi is not clear, and scholars translate the term as divine commandments, divine powers, or even mythic virtues. The me, however, are described as physical objects that one could pick up and carry, or even put on, and which contained secret knowledge or data. Perhaps they were something like our present-day computer chips, on which data, programs, and operational orders have been minutely recorded. On them, the essentials of civilization were encoded. These Mii's were in the possession of Enki, the chief scientist of the Anunnaki. They were released by him to benefit mankind gradually, step by step, and the turn of Erech to attain the heights of civilization had apparently not yet come when Inanna became its resident deity. Impatient, Inanna decided to use her feminine charms to improve the situation. A text titled by S.N. Kramer as Inanna and Enki, but whose original and more poetic Sumerian title is unknown, describes how Inanna journeyed in her boat of heaven to the Abzu, where Enki had secreted away the Mii's. Realizing that Inanna was coming to call on him by herself, the maiden, all alone, has directed her step to the Abzu. Enki ordered his chamberlain to prepare a sumptuous meal, including plenty of date wine. After Inanna and Enki had feasted, and Enki's heart became happy with drink, Inanna brought up the subject of the Mii's. Gracious with drink, Enki presented to her Mi for lordship, godship, the exalted and enduring tiara, the throne of kingship, and bright Inanna took them. As Inanna worked her charms on her aging host, Enki made to her a second presentation of the exalted scepter and staff, the exalted shrine, righteous rulership, and bright Inanna took them, too. As the feasting and drinking went on, Enki parted with 7 major Mii's, embracing the functions and attributes of a divine lady, her temple and rituals, its priests, eunuchs and prostitutes, warfare and weapons, justice and courts, music and arts, masonry, woodworking and metalworking, leatherwork and weaving, scribeship and mathematics, and so on. With the encoded data for all these attributes of a high civilization in her hands, Inanna slipped away and took off in her boat of heaven back to Erech. Hours later, a sobered Enki realized that Inanna and the Mii's were gone. His somewhat embarrassed chamberlain reminded Enki that he, Enki himself, had made the Mii's a present to Inanna. Greatly upset, Enki ordered his chamberlain to pursue Inanna in Enki's great heavenly sky chamber and retrieve the Mii's. Overtaking Inanna at the first stopping point, the chamberlain explained to Inanna his orders, but Inanna, asking, "Why had Enki changed his word to me?" refused. Reporting the situation to Enki, the chamberlain was ordered to seize Inanna's boat of heaven, bring the boat to Eridu, and release Inanna, but without the Mii's. But in Eridu, Inanna ordered her trusted pilot to save the boat of heaven, and the Mii's presented to Inanna. And so, while Inanna kept the argument with Enki's chamberlain going, her pilot slipped away in her boat with the invaluable Mii's. An exaltation of Inanna, composed to be read responsively by a congregation, echoes the sentiments of the people of Erech. Lady of the Mii's, queen brightly resplendent, righteous, clothed in radiance, beloved of heaven and earth, Eridule of Anu, wearing the great adorations for the exalted tiara appropriate, for the high priesthood suitable, the 7 Mii's she attained. In her hand she is holding, Lady of the Great Mii's, of them she is the guardian. It was in those days that Inanna was incorporated into the pantheon of 12, and replacing Ninharsag was assigned the planet Venus, Muldilbat, as her celestial counterpart, and the constellation Ab-Sin, Virgo, as her zodiac house, The latter's depiction has hardly changed from Sumerian times, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 79. Expressing her own gratification, Inanna announced for all, gods and men alike, to hear, "A queen am I." Hymns acknowledged her new status among the gods and her celestial attributes. To the one who comes forth from heaven, to the one who comes forth from heaven, hail, we do say. Loftiness, greatness, reliability are hers, as she comes forth radiantly in the evening. A holy torch that fills the heavens, her stance in heaven is like the moon and sun. In heaven she is secure, the good wild cow of Anu. On earth she is enduring, mistress of the lands. In the Abzu, from Eridu, she received the Mies. Her godfather Enki presented them to her. Lordship and kingship he placed in her hand. With Anu she takes her seat upon the great throne. With Enlil she determines the fates in her land. Turning from her high position among the gods to her worship by the Sumerians, the black-headed people, the hymns went on. In all the land the black-headed people assemble when abundance has been placed in the storehouses of Sumer. They come to her with... They bring disputes before her. She renders judgment to the evil and destroys the wicked. She favors the just, determines good fate for them. The good lady, the joy of Anu, a heroine she is. She surely comes forth from heaven. She is mighty, she is trustworthy, she is great. She is exceeding in youthfulness. The people of Erech had every reason to be thankful to Inanna, for under her deityship, Erech had become an affluent center of Sumerian civilization. In praising her wisdom and valor, the people of Erech failed not also to mention her beauty and attractiveness. Indeed, it was at about that time that Inanna instituted the custom of the sacred marriage, sexual rites whereby the priest-king was supposed to have become her spouse, but only for a night. A text, attributed to a king named Idin-Dagan, described this aspect of Inanna's temple life, with music, male prostitute entertainers, and all. The male prostitutes comb her hair. They decorate the neck with colored bands. Their right side they adorn with women's clothing, as they walk before the pure Inanna. Their left side they cover with men's clothing, as they walk before the pure Inanna. With jump ropes and colored cords, they compete before her. The young men, carrying hoops, sing before her. The maidens, Shugia priestesses, walk before Inanna. They set up a bed for my lady. They cleanse rushes with sweet-smelling cedar oil. For Inanna, for the king, they arrange the bed. The king approaches her pure lap proudly. Proudly he approaches the lap of Inanna. He caresses her pure lap. She stretches out on the bed, the pure lap. She makes love with him on her bed. She says to Idin-Dagan, "Surely you are my beloved." This habit of Inanna may have begun with Enmerkar himself, a sexual union of which the next ruler of Uruk, a demigod known as Divine Lugalbanda, a righteous supervisor, was the progeny. Of Lugalbanda, too, as of Enmerkar, several epic tales have been found. Inanna, it seems, wanted him to reside in her stead in Irata, but Lugalbanda was too restless and adventurous to stay put. One epic tale describes his dangerous journey to the awesome place on earth in search of the divine black bird. He reached the restricted mount where the Anunnaki, gods of the mountain, inside the earth like termites had tunneled. Seeking a ride in the bird of heaven, Lugalbanda pleaded with its custodian. His words immortalized man's desire to fly. "Like Utu, let me go. Like Inanna, like the seven stormers of Ishkar, in a flame let me lift myself off and thunder away. Let me go wherever my eyes can see. Wherever I desire, let me set my foot. Wherever my heart wishes, let me arrive." When he had arrived at Mount Hurum, whose front and lil, as with a great door, had closed off, Lugalbanda was challenged by the guardian. "If a god you are, a word in friendship will I utter, which will let you enter. If a man you are, your fate will I decree." To which Lugalbanda, he of beloved seed,